Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Social and Political Dissent in Pashto Poetry, The Case of Malang Zhang, by Dr. James Karen of the University of Pennsylvania. This is the first lecture in a series hosted by MES at MCU. The lecture series is entitled Multidisciplinary Approach to the AFPAC Region and Its People. Dr. Karen is a lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania, where he received his PhD in South Asian Regional Studies in 2009. He's done fieldwork in Kabul and Peshawar and specializes in the social and cultural history of mid-20th century Afghanistan. He teaches courses on modern Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Islam in South Asia. This presentation took place Wednesday, 20 January 2010, from 1400 to 1530 at Graves Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Entitled this program as Multidisciplinary Approach to AFPAC Region and Its People. And I want to underline the people part of it. This comes out directly from the commander's intent from General McChrystal's views on how we should deal with the AFPAC issues. And if, those of you have read General McChrystal's directive, what I'm talking about is the seventh page that was given to ISAF soldiers deploying, and I have it here, I can read for you. The key point says the Afghan people are the objective. Then it goes on, think before you act. Be an expert on local situation. Afghan culture is founded on personal relationships. This is all directly read from there. Listen to and learn from Afghan colleagues. Communicate and share ideas. Challenge the conventional wisdom if it no longer fits the environment. In this battle, you have to learn and adapt as things change. It keeps on talking about the people. General McChrystal goes on even to talk about that killing is not good in this. And he has a new map, he says, and puts a conventional map in his head, that if you kill two, you're actually making more insurgents. Rather, you have to get the people, because the battle is for the Afghan people's hearts and minds. And we have to learn that. Based on that reality, and personally, I think I not only agree with that, I fully endorse it, because I have been trying to say that for several years, even before I joined the Marine Corps University. We have been very fortunate with the support of Dr. Wilson, who's the Vice President of Academic Affairs, sitting in front, and Adam Seitz, who's standing there. Without him, none of this would be possible, but we have been fortunate enough to put a series of lectures to discuss aspects of the Afghan-Pakistan region, mainly the Pashtun people who live on between those two countries, which I believe are not gaining a lot of attention, at least not in the PME and the military at large, which is notions of who the Pashtuns are, not just post 9/11 or post Taliban. We seem to be talking mostly about these people in the notion that they were from our mindset when they came into our philosophy, which is either we really go back into the Soviet period, if not, it is Taliban 9/11. Yet these people have been there for a while. And this disconnect, I think, has made us speak in parallels rather than at each other, even when we are friends to each other. So based on that, and I won't say much because we are very lucky to have a guest speaker here. I heard a few months ago that there was an American scholar. At the time I had no idea he was born in the great state of Maine, but an American scholar who actually had written his dissertation recently, 2009, University of Pennsylvania, on a poet by the name of Malang Zhang. Okay. When I heard that, I could not even believe that somebody had done that. And I went all the way to Boston, Massachusetts to listen to this man. And I'm very, very glad, and we're all very glad that Dr. James Karen has accepted to be the first of the speakers. I will discuss more at the end about the forthcoming talks. We can tell you that the next one is actually coming up in February 18th. It is Robert McChesney, my own professor, who will be talking about the historical, how the Afghans see their own history. And Adam and I have flyers on that. And if you want to be put on our mailing list, please see either myself or Adam, and we will put you on that. And we will encourage you to come Every month we will have one speaker. Robert McChesney is next month. In the month of March we have Ambassador Dahlgren and so on. Now to our main point today, which is Dr. James Cannon. Dr. Cannon, as I said, did his PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. Currently, he teaches two courses at the University of Pennsylvania. One is on Islam and nationalism in South Asia, which mainly covers Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India. He just told me he does not cover Bangladesh. Also, he coordinates the Pashto language instructions at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Cannon has worked both in Kabul, in Afghanistan, and in Peshawar, and specializes in social and cultural history of mid-20th century Afghanistan. He is not only fluent in Pashto language, he's also fluent in Urdu. Without further ado, I leave the floor to you. Thank you again for coming. And Dr. Cannon will speak for about 40 minutes, and then we'd like to engage you in a question and answer period. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Professor Jersey, and thanks for inviting me, and thanks to you all for coming. Thanks especially to Adam for working so hard on this. The title for my paper today is Social and Political Dissent in Pashto Poetry. And I'm primarily talking about the case of Madame Jean. I brought some poems with me, but I think I'll leave those to the end if we have time to read out the translations. I mean, they're interesting. But for me, the really interesting part of this is really I was interested in poetry and these kind of things initially, not for its own sake, but more to answer a question that I had, which was Madame Jean. So here was, he had no land, he had no family of any great note, he couldn't read or write, he worked as a casual laborer, like basically a sharecropper at times, and a very marginal person in a lot of ways. How is it possible that this person came to be like the strongest articulator of Pashtun nationalism in basically mid-20th century history in Afghanistan, number one? Number two, every kind of source that I had seen estimated Afghan literacy at the time is about 5%, and we have no doubt that a lot of this was concentrated in cities and urban environments, which is not where Madame Jean spent his life. At the same time, it's almost a cliche, like a stereotype, that Pakhtuns or Pashtuns are and have been for quite a while among the most nationalistic and ethnically proud ethnic groups basically on the face of the earth. So we usually kind of figure that nationalism, these kind of things, presuppose a high level of mass media and in order to bring your population onto the same ideological page, as it were. If literacy is at 5%, and radio is number one, embryonic in its scope in 1950, and number two, doesn't really penetrate a lot of these valleys and regions. Where does this nationalism come from? What's the medium, in other words? What is the mass media? There has to be one. So it seems that Madame Jean kind of answered both of the questions at the same time. We analyze his career and the things that he did and the things that happened to him and the environment he was in. So that's my talk, really. The talk is essentially, I've got two concerns. First, Madame Jean was a protest poet for most of his career, which is the reason for titling this talk Dissent, social dissent and political dissent. So the first concern is to show what kind of things that he was expressing dissent against. And that turns out actually to be tribalism. And tribalism in this case, if the new conventional thinking is to discard the old conventional thinking, if it doesn't adapt to your environment anymore. So tribalism has always been the conventional wisdom. I mean, this is a fundamentally tribal society, or so we thought. In fact, Madame Jean is expressing a major kind of grassroots discontent with tribalism. And so the first concern in my paper is that by analyzing this kind of poetry, we see that tribalism is not, an overall feature of life so much as it is an elite feature of life that people don't like on the bottom. And number two, social dissent appears to be, and this kind of mass medium expressed through poetry, then as now, appears to be aligned against tribalism. And so what happens when your mass medium is kind of aligned against the very thing that your government is trying to rule you with in the case of Michigan? So the first concern here is I use the concept of patriarchy in a very, very strict sense, which means rule by the father or father-like individual. I mean, this is the actual roots of this word. Right? Rule by lineage, which goes through elders and such things. One of my chief hypotheses here is that this kind of rule through lineage and through elders was not just a feature of not being governed. It was actually a feature of being governed by the Afghan state, and that's how the Afghan state ruled. And that's why protest movements in the 1950s, as in the 1990s, and continuing to this day, tend to, for example, the Taliban Islamic movement. Taliban, I mean, this is not a new social movement, right? There have been Taliban going back like 100 years that we have records for. Tend to, you know, speak very strongly against tribal divisions and tribal identity in general. So, first thesis is that patriarchy, and we can include patron-client paternalism type structures in patriarchy. Number one, this was not just descriptive, this was normative on the part of the state as part of rule. And number two, if that's true, we can chart the way that a patriarchal state ideology is replicated in subjects. So how do people internalize the rule that's on top of them? That's the first kind of chunk of concern. And the second part is, in both cases, in the 1950s as now, it's a form of populist nationalism spread primarily through face-to-face oral networks. Poetry in the 1950s, but actually, you know, there's a ton of Taliban poetry around right now, and people know this is important. Populist nationalism, whether Islamist or not, spread primarily through face-to-face oral networks, is the main medium that's aligning populist opinion against these patron-client hierarchies. So I kind of rely on the concept of public space. My bigger argument is that, number one, tribal society, this lineage, is organized by states or by colonial authorities or governing authorities of all kinds, itself sets up a structure for the circulation of information and ideologies and opinions and stuff like that. Also, point number two is that many marginal oral poets in society at the time constituted an alternate public space that functioned beneath and technically outside of this kind of patriarchal ruling structure. And so I'm claiming that these features of oral media in the Afghan Pashto setting enabled anti-monarchist cosmopolitan intellectuals sitting in Kabul and Jalalabad and places like that to organize with oral poets from very marginal backgrounds, like fishermen. I don't know if you know this, but fishermen are not a highly respected group of people in traditional society. Fishermen, sharecroppers, office servants, oral poets were largely from these demographics as much as anyone else. This enabled cosmopolitan intellectuals to join forces with cosmopolitan intellectuals who sought to basically force constitutional monarchy onto a monarchy that was very inclined to absolutism. In essence, what we see happening in the 1950s, is that those intellectuals in the cities piggybacked on, number one, mosque networks and Friday preachers, and number two, even more on oral poets, to stitch together an infrastructure, a mass medium, that expanded through, essentially from Helmand to Gunnar province, the entire belt. So if this is all kind of abstract and opaque, probably be easiest just to start talking about the history that you can kind of uncover when you start analyzing the biographies of marginal poets like this. So what happened? In 1929, there was a reformist and centrist king, 28 actually, reformist and centrist king Amanullah Shah, was deposed by a series of peasant insurrections, you know, in many parts of the Afghan kingdom. And the end result was that it led to the establishment of a rule by a Tajik commoner, the so-called Bacha Sapao, the son of the water carrier. A former actually military subaltern in the Afghan military. This is a history that you don't often hear about, nonetheless. So Bacha Sapao came in, and almost immediately, so Pashtun aristocrats at the center began their campaigns of reconquest, and they were faced and, you know, basically they took refuge in various parts. But they began their campaigns of reconquest. But they couldn't, they couldn't just accomplish this reconquest by themselves. So the Musaban family relied very heavily on the military force of Waziri tribesmen from the heavily populated but resource-poor what is now Pakhtal province and Waziristan to a lesser extent. And the Musaban Sardars also relied heavily on the intercession of less aristocratic Pashtuns to translate their case outwards into a social vocabulary of masculine Pashtun chivalry, as well as holding out military awards. I mean, when you start to look through the Kabul Hall map in the mid-30s, it's wild. When you look at it, lists all of the top-ranking military officials, and in the Sefeh Stalda, this is the active duty. In the active duty, I mean, something like 13 out of 15 generals were Pashtuns, and of those, like, something like 9 in 1935 were identifiably by their last name from a southern, like a, you know, a Amazigh or Wazir kind of, not Jabhat al-Amazigh, right? The kind of Amazigh Wazir background, or Pakhtiyar tribal background, highly tribal. So what is this? This is basically a form of redistribution through access to power as opposed to money. So yeah, they held out material rewards, but part of this was also, part of the reason for the insurrections in the first place was that the Afghan state was perceived to be too distant from rural elders. And so, you know, in the 1930s, you start to see a strong lip service to Pashtun ideology in the Afghan state. Whether this reflects Pashtun culture or not is highly debatable, and I'd probably say it isn't, but we can talk about that later. So anyway, retaining the support of both the tribes and their aristocratic intermediaries, the people who actually pled the case on behalf of the crown, because the people at the center at the time couldn't even speak Pashto. They were completely, I mean, they were Pashtun in blood, right? And that's about it. They needed people between them and the people in order to translate the case, like people who could move equally well between both worlds. One of these is the general, subsequently interior minister. At the same time he was interior minister, he ran all these cultural organizations. At the same time as that, he was the governor of each province, you know, one after another, basically to quell insurrections. A man named Wazir Muhammad Gulkhan Momand. So Gulkhan is worthy of further attention because more than any other of these aristocratic intermediaries, he represents the nexus between this patriarchal state that's establishing itself and the people on the ground. And you know, the nexus between a patriarchal state and the way that this patriarchal state established itself in the minds of people. So he was born in Kabul from Momand's family, which had been close to the court for generations, like about 100 years. He was a career military officer. Quelling unrest in province after province, how did he do that? Well, it's not entirely clear because we have very few records from that period, because it was basically open rural warfare for a good portion of that time. But it looks like he would use Pashtun migrants as kind of an unofficial military force of shock troops to suppress non-Pashtun peasant unrest, also other unrest among other Pashtuns. So it's a form of military patronage, right? Selectively giving out not only resources like money, but also the right to domestically conquer people. And then, as I say, a lot of those lineages that he was using as unofficial military forces eventually were allowed to buy into the actual formal Afghan national military. But besides his role as a kind of state tribal military aristocrat, Muhammad Bulhan was also an intellectual. So he wrote the first indigenous grammar of Pashto. And he put forth, like, basically the first argument for why Afghanistan should be ruled, why Pashtunism should be ruled. More than that, even, so I'm not going to quote that here, we don't have anything like the time, but more than that, he put into the public sphere a codification of everything that he considered to be Pashtun culture, authentic Pashtun culture. And really, which according to popular language ideologies that still are relevant, all of this ideology is part and parcel of the Pashtun language too. So there's a cliche, right? You don't speak Pashtun, you do it, or you have it. Basically, you embody Pashtun rather than speak it, and it's part of your social personality. So anyway, what does he claim? From 1945, what is he claiming? What is essentially what the state considers to be tribal values and manly values and chivalrous values? Well, I quote now, Pashto is nobility or pure breeding, its competitive worthiness, Pashto is salvation and dignified stature, its honor, respect, prestige. In Pashto, there's no dishonor or degradation because Pashtuns don't accept that. Pashto is being noble and freeborn, its lordship. There's no oppression in Pashto. Confronting the weak or the powerless with power is not Pashto. In Pashto, there's no tolerance of being oppressed either. It's being free from want or being wealthy or self-sufficient. It's self-reliance. There's no petitioning in Pashto. And petitions and supplications are not Pashto. Pashto is contentment. So we see in that portion some of the... So this would seem to be a highly egalitarian ethos. And people still believe in it very heavily today. When you start to read poems like Malang Jang and things by, and actually when you start to look at how the Taliban comport themselves, you get the feeling that this was actually not an egalitarian ethos at all. It seemed to be an elite one. It was held very strongly by, you know, tribal aristocrats because they were equal to anybody. Anyway, so in that portion, you see some of this elite ideology setting up the place of man in the world as both self-sovereign and willing to accept his place in the world's hierarchy as long as that hierarchy is just. The authority over him is beneficent and legitimate. It looks destructured, sure. Dominance seems to be relative rather than absolute, right? In that kind of political system that he's describing. There's more. So in going from this abstract idea of Pashtunness into a specific ruling system, he says, well, in Pashtun regions, everybody's life, property, and honor is safeguarded by Pashto, and anyone who brings harm to the fellow countrymen of Pashtuns will become their enemy, and the master of one region is required by Pashto to defend his people's property and honor from aggressors, or else, you know, pay for their losses himself. Actually the language, I can't, you can't get it in translation. He's describing mastership in the same way he's describing husbandhood, and in the same way he's describing lordship. So you see this kind of, I believe the word was like sakhtan or halwand for master. Which is the same as Lord and the same as husband. So he's kind of, and in the rest of this passage that I excerpted this from, there's a whole bunch of other language that's setting up the equivalency between your area and your home. So this is Pashto for the elder, right? But what happens if you're like the ill-favored stepchild and you don't have an extended family and all this? So here's where the oral poetry comes in. So ideology like this was even replicated in a patriarchal form of medium. So basically, this went through face-to-face meetings of elite people with lesser elite people on a more local scale. So it's describing nested authority structure, based on a district model, and within the district there's a sub-district, until you get down to the village. And when you go to the village, who do you deal with? You don't go straight to everybody, you go to the elder. So this is how information traditionally was circulated, and we have some research on this, but not nearly enough. Anyway, it should be noted, let's say, that if Pashtunness for elites is so heavily tied up in self-sovereignty through collective control of land and family and lordship over other social groups, not everybody can buy into that, not everybody has that access. Even Pashto-speaking dependent groups, you know, can't live up to Pashto itself. And so here's where the oral poetry comes in. These were intellectuals, right? We don't usually think of them that way because they're also like a carpenter or a fisherman or whatever, or a mullah. But they were professionals, and like other professionals, like a carpenter, they operated on the local level very much like any other dependent. They were dependent on the Khan, the local elder. So it's like you didn't have a lot of scope to criticize this guy as long as he's the guy who's paying your bills. Not only that, so each Khan kind of had his own retinue of poets that were sort of linked to him, sort of not. And they would compete against each other. And this would, like, they would get prestige from their Khan and their Khan would get prestige from them. I don't really want to go into the specifics of these competitions. But let's just say that, you know, there were these village competitions. The one who lost, the poet and his retinue who lost, would actually have to give up the means of their craft. Like, they have to surrender their musical instruments to the guy who won. We have a bunch of research on this, but not really as much as we'd like. So, now we've got to look at these kind of two levels of information circulating around. You have a bunch of marginal people who are talking to each other at all times, and they're fighting against each other poetically. But that information is flowing, right, in a very horizontal fashion on the ground level. At the same time, you have this kind of top-down thing that's kind of keeping them in check, which is keeping the terms of the circulation local. And it's keeping these people from really criticizing upwards in any given location. Now, so what changed? By the time we have Alang Jang coming along, this is really the first, genres changed. I mean, we start to get, in previous periods, you have like snarky love poetry, poetry making fun of like dishonorable husbands and stuff. And that's about as political as it got, except for an anti-imperial war, so like battle poetry. On a day-to-day level, the extent of criticism was this little sarcastic stuff. By 1950, there's actually poetic political science. I mean, it's incredible, the rhetorical sophistication of these oral poets. It's like, they'll give you a thesis statement. Just like any of you in classes here or teaching classes, you know, you have a thesis statement, and then you have paragraphs. And each of the paragraphs explores a ramification of the thesis, and then you go back to the thesis and do another one and keep on going down until you're done with your poem. It would last like 20 minutes. And you know, by 1950, you have these marginal kind of characters making direct structural criticism of the state that they live in. So they're talking about like how the accountant helps the district official to steal your money, and how the global political economy like drains wealth from Afghanistan, and it's all helped by these corrupt state officials, and how you can't really say much because if you do, then they'll just whip you with willow switches, and you know, subject you to this really humiliating. Basically, you know, if your father is the guy who protects you in this metaphor, your father's also the guy who beats you, so you get these like incredibly satirical, witty poems talking about how the state official, you know, exacts all kinds of humiliating degradations. Basically, he's like the bad cop without being the good cop. Or like, you know, your disciplinary father without being the father that actually helps you thrive in life. And stuff like that. Where did we get this kind of grassroots political science from? Well, yeah, it does come from the genius of the poet himself, right? But on the other hand, It also comes from the actual interaction between your grassroots poets and other people who have a kind of bigger scope. So if you're stuck on the village level, you can't really criticize much above you. If you're on the provincial level as a poet, then you can certainly criticize everybody on the village level. Why not? It's very easy to do that at that time, because nobody on any one level, like on the ground level, can touch you anymore. So how did they get projected onto the provincial level? Well, it seems that reformist intellectuals in the cities helped them do that. Who am I talking about? Well, these guys were basically what you would now call mullahs. They were well-educated, though. So it's like they got educated at home in the traditional religious sciences, then started to work in like state cultural spheres. Now, they were pushing for egalitarianism. Their Islam told them that, look, in Islam, all men are equal, and you have to have this kind of monarchy, in other words, is not what we're after. So they were pushing for parliamentary democracy. They were also the people running the Tashkent Academy, and they were also the people, somebody before this lecture came up to me and talked to me about the Blooming Orange Festival, the Orange Blossom Festival, held every spring in Jalalabad City, which is an enormously huge public festival of poetry. Now, the state brought out a lot of these poet festivals to the Jhumpade itself, so you'd have a patron there, and he'd be like the provincial, well, the governor in a lot of cases. So the governor would be there, and he would try and deal with these poets the same way as the village khan, the village elder, would deal with his local poets. So it's basically, to keep them in check, you give them rewards if they do good, and you don't hire them again if they do bad. And when you bestow, you know, rewards on them, this isn't just a financial reward, even though it's a sizable chunk of money for this poor guy. It's also honor, and it's also respect and prestige and all this stuff. And when you accept that reward, you solidify your subordination to your patron, right? It's a very asymmetrical relationship. It's almost like a chain of command in a lot of ways. So these state officials who are trying to run this in a tribal sort of fashion would try and, you know, operate in the same way. But unfortunately, they weren't terribly well educated a lot of the time. And furthermore, they didn't want to deal with the nitty-gritty of setting up state festivals and all this stuff. So every time, you know, the state tried to come along and use one of these things to solidify its dominance in a tribal sort of way, and also to celebrate Afghan independence, and there would be like songs praising the king and his family and all the regional families that were important. At the same time, there's something else going on here. And all of these people who are actually managing the events are helping these local poets to kind of avoid this show of humility and subordination. So, like, I talked to one of the, basically, the last remaining guy of this generation who was doing this kind of work. He said, like, oh yeah, there's this one time when Lalan John, the poet that I'm talking about, they were at this festival, and the governor of Nangarhar tried to get in, it was Mashriki, trying to get him to accept this big old award, right after Malanjong had presented an entire morning of basically critical political science to the like thousands of people assembled there. So clearly you don't want this massive criticism in your face if you're the ruling official. So the ruling official tried to like salvage the situation and try and say, like, oh yeah, well, this just goes to show how beneficent of patrons we are, that we allow this kind of thing, and I'm going to give you a reward because we like you, and you know, basically to solidify his dominance over that group once more after they were slipping out of his control. And what's interesting is that the manager of the event comes in and says, oh yeah, thanks for the award, but I think that we're going to take this as basically a sign of how popular this group is with the people. Now that's more important than it sounds at first blush, right? The people. But if your society is structured in a fragmented way, according to like tribe, or if not tribe, then district and village, and going up in this nested thing all the way up to one guy at the top, why would you have a concept of the people at all, right? You'd have a concept of your place in a specific kind of structure, as opposed to the people. By this point, this combined amount of public poetry and these kind of public events, and the repeated invoking of the people was actually busy creating a concept of the people in the people. All the people on the outside of this structure, you know, this top-down structure, actually now had a different view of the world in which they could fit themselves. The people, or the Pashtun nation. Milam John was great for talking about the Pashtun nation. And so, you know, so essentially, like, any time that I talk to people in a group, you know, there's ways of using language that's going to include everybody or exclude people. So I was given a speech in Kabul once, and, you know, when I'm talking to the Academy of Sciences, I'm talking in Pashtun, and I'm saying, we at this event. And it really includes basically only the intellectuals there and not all the office servants. The office servants are present physically at the event, but the language is excluding them. It's not intended to be addressed to them. If, on the other hand, you say, ladies and gentlemen of the Academy of Sciences and the staff and all the people here, this is an address to all of you. It includes everybody. It gives a sense of group feelingness, right? That everybody's the same in your audience. And everybody is your audience. When you say, ladies, or I should probably in this period, gentlemen of the Khalil tribe, gentlemen of the Bisugwal, you know, gentlemen of whatever, Khulgyane in this region, Chinware, you know, by listing all these different names, you're reinforcing your exclusion of categories. If you say the Khmer people, you're creating a nation at the same time you claim to be discussing a nation, right? So, you know, the address that you use and the language that you use is very powerful. And this is what the combined effect of oral poetry had in the 1940s and 50s. Now, was this just an organic thing that sprung up from the ground? Actually, no, it wasn't. There was an underground liberal party called the Lit Zun Yang, or the Enlightened Youth. Now, Lit Zun Yang is clearly, you know, when you claim like youth as a mass category, what you're doing is, you know, it's a direct attack on rule by the father, right? So they were aiming at something quite different. Instead of rule by the father, and don't forget, the king is the father of the nation, just like your district, your Vaswab is like the father of your tribe, the administrative father of your tribe. If you're claiming that enlightened youth are the inheritors of the political authority of your land, this is a direct assault on the metaphorical vocabulary of your state. So, Liu Zongyang were trying to push parliamentary democracy, and they were trying to push nationalism as a way to achieve this. Among, you know, essentially, this was a mid-1940s to 50s Hearts and Minds campaign, and it was far more successful than anything you see happening now, except for actually the Taliban, right? I'm sorry to say that. Much as it depresses me to say that, you know, at least the Lit Zun Yang were an incredibly progressive and very tolerant group. In any case, how did they, was this, so, like, the question is, did this national conception just come up from, you know, the grassroots, or was it intended? Was it an actual campaign? And it wasn't a campaign. So I met with one of the campaigners, right? One of the organizers of the Lit Zun Yang. They had outreach coordinators. One of them is still alive. He lives in Hyderabad in Peshawar city. And so I met with him, and he said, yeah, well, we knew what we were doing. So what we would do is, we knew that the royal family itself controlled all the print in this country. Even when there are private presses, they read every single article that went out and punished, you know, people that they didn't like and censored everything that they didn't like. We knew that we couldn't do anything too drastic through print. And we knew that we couldn't do anything too drastic through radio because we really didn't control much of it. And, you know, because Pakistan was also, you know, strongly putting out its own radio and propaganda. Instead, we built on our strengths, which was, number one, remember they were religious scholars. Number one, networks of religious scholars. So, like, you get all these sort of documents from, like, the district court judge of Jalalabad City saying, oh yeah, patriarchy is the worst thing ever, and Islam tells us that, you know, everybody should be progressive and all this stuff. So they made, you know, a very strong campaign with, number one, junior mosque officials, the people who actually talked to people on a daily basis, and number two, with oral poets, because every wedding you had one of these guys singing. And every circumcision party, you had one of these guys singing. Even at, like, your weekly market, you know, in this part of Afghanistan at that time, you didn't really have market towns. You had a weekly market, people would come and they would meet there. It was like a fair, and there were oral poets there. So what the Wits of Leon did was they used their leverage as state officials to make sure that the poets that they knew well and worked with would get invited to the right weddings, and to, you know, they would, you know, maybe get a little money to travel, and once they traveled somewhere, they could earn some extra money from, you know, taking donations from people at the fair and stuff. They made sure, in essence, that these people got their, you know, their fair forum, I guess, and just kind of trusted that this mass consciousness would be the thing that kind of. So, in other words, they didn't really try and control what the people were saying. They just kind of made sure that the right people were, you know, heard by the right other people. Just basically just everyone. I mean, they were trying to create a broad-based national consciousness. And actually, does this have any relevance today? It sort of does. We don't have these kind of, now we have market towns in Oklahoma. Right, that's where you buy your stuff. But, you know, poetry festivals blow up all over the place. There's more than there used to be. And furthermore, you know, this kind of tradition of establishing a poetry festival is, it's like there was no free speech in print. There was little free speech in radio. But nobody was going to take away your free speech at one of these things. And it went to the extent, I'll just end with an anecdote, proving kind of how inviolable this free speech is. I think it was sometime around 1998 or 1999 that the Taliban were in power in Jalalabad, and there was a major demonstration in Jalalabad Medical College among students. And the Taliban shot up a bunch of students, and it was a massacre. The poet Abdul Barda Jahani, one of the best known current contemporary Pashto poets working right now, he lives around here, I think, right? He works for the Voice of America. Jahani said he was very upset by this. So I'm not getting this from Jahani himself. I'm getting it from just maybe secondhand. It may be urban legend by this point. I don't know. But it said that Jahani said was very incensed. He flew straight to Afghanistan at the next one of these poetry festivals. I believe it was the Arctic Blossom Festival. He was wearing a business suit and clean shaven at the height of Taliban power. Went straight into this poetry festival, read a big old poem about how Taliban, you know, did the wrong thing and massacred people. And Taliban, I'm sure you would imagine, are among the least tolerant regimes of free speech anywhere around. And what happened to Jahani? Said nothing. You know, he got back on the plane and went home, event free. At the current time, I mean, if you're looking for really funny satire of the Karzai administration, just go on YouTube and Google the Orange Blossom Festival or these kind of things. Yeah, it's all over the place, and it's actually quite witty. All this kind of stuff. What do you think? I mean, can this reformist tendency be channeled in a constructive direction? Well, I suppose it can. A lot of my initial thoughts on this state structure and the idea of a public float underneath there was sparked by the philosopher Sayyid Bahauddin Majruk, who wrote a book that unfortunately doesn't exist in English yet. So he's talking about how it's an allegory. There's this dictator, and the dictator is clamping down on all aspects of life. And it talks about how, like, the forces of good and love and affection that had been used to construct this, like, palace that this dictator was living in. He arrested them and forced them into chains and stuck them in a dungeon where they just kind of thrived and grew and festered until, you know, they popped back out, like, exploded out of the foundations of this structure and kind of wiped away everything with biblical intensity. So, you know, it's the same forces, in other words. Once you force them underground, you then, you know, squash them for longer. Under the Afghan monarchic and republican system at this, in this particular philosophical description, then, you know, that's what happens. You're not going to stop this kind of public organization, not now. I mean, that's out of the bottle. There's no making that river flow backwards. So yeah, I guess actually this is half like workshop paper at this point. So I'm sure that there are people here who have more experience in rural parts of Afghanistan than I do. And it'd be great to open it up to discussion and questions.
I'm Fajr Abid from Pakistan, and I belong to the same area. I'm born in Peshawar, and my grandfather migrated from Kandahar, and they got settled in this area because there was no
right.
Sport and everything. I think there are many Malamjans, one you identified by chance. There are many Malamjans, and you know, the Ganjai tribe, which it did all service to these Malamjans because they would nomad. They would travel to the Indus Basin in summers, go back to the reaches of Hindu Kush.
Certainly.
Go back to Samarkand, Bukhara, come back, bring those Malamjan type things, their sayings, their poetries, maybe right. Many things. They would go to like Irish Kyle and would go to bar there, would be Kawa Khanas, means tea bars.
Of course, right.
They would sit there, a whole lot of a bazaar in Peshawar like Kissa Khani, where these intellectuals would come. They would travel to different places, they would bring those things, they would be against, mostly against the kings and these khans and those, and they would narrate those things in Kissa Khani Bazaar. Kissa Khani means a bazaar or a mark, a place where you come and tell your stories.
Yes.
So there's a whole lot, there's a small little village near Peshawar which is Hazar Khani, which means thousand tales.
It's my favorite place
there. This is your favorite place, my grandfather is buried there. So you see, there are lots of Malamjan, and Pashtun is not an abstract thing. It is a code of life, it is a conduct, and it is full of dignity and grace. It is not like violence against innocent people. Pashtuns are not there to go and cut heads and behead people. This is this culture of Central Asia, of Laku Khan and Genghis Khan, these Chechens that they have gone, come into this society. This was never Pashtuns. If you are traveling with your wife and your enemy comes, he would just not even look towards you. There was honor and grace. You have tales of Ajab Khan who took Alice and he killed his brother because his brother tried to be nasty with Alice. So you see the dignity and pride and things in Pashtun culture. So my point here is that there are many Malamjans, and these cultural exchanges between people like Jashn-e-Khaybar in Peshawar, Jashn-e-Kabul in Kabul. As a small child that I used to go with my father and come back. But now, I just can't take my son that side of it. I can just tell him, that's an anecdote thing. But I think the great service that these people can do, open people to people contact between, and that animosity of these things, because the most, the people who suffered a lot in this was the Pashtuns itself. And somebody wants to divide us, somebody wants to do something, somebody wants every Pashtun a Taliban, every Taliban a Pashtun, I do not know what type of thing. And I forgive those people because they are very naive in their thinking. They have not gone to those areas, they have not studied culture like you. You were part of that culture. We have seen people sitting here, I listened to many comments of people that they talk just fantasizing the environment. I'm using the wrong terminology, but they just fantasize around and they make comments. So my here view would be that there are many Malamjans in Pashtun society which needs recognition, and if they are recognized, like today it is internet, you are talking of Google and Twitter and everything, this nomadic population and Kissa Khani and this Jashn-e-Kabul and Jashn-e-Peshawar and everything was Twitters and Facebooks of that time.
Absolutely.
So this was the concept of that time that it didn't happen. But I feel very disgusted in America. I come because here people come and they talk like this, they even do not know that what are they talking. They just fantasize that they pick up telephone, talk to somebody in Islamabad or Kabul, just fly over to Afghanistan and they go write a book on something. So these, I don't call them intellectuals also, they are rogue intellectuals because they try to demonize a very, very dignified society of this world, that they demonize them like people killing people and suicide and this. And you being a professor, very rightly, and I'm very thankful to you that you brought up and you spent time.
Well, I mean,
the
people on the LGBTQ are extremely hospitable. I mean, that's the first thing. You're right. I think that if you're going to be responsible in writing the history, I'm a historian, if you're going to be responsible in writing the history of a region, the first thing you should do is find out what the people in that region say about themselves. And for better or for worse, the most that we have. So Afghanistan was not like the British Empire. We don't have land ranging records. We don't have much records of anything at all except for oral records and poems and stuff. And so, I mean, there's plenty of stuff to be found in there. And furthermore, you get a fuller picture of the full range of society if you look at not only the top, but the bottom two. And that was my original point in doing it. So the second thing is, when you start to look at the sources, you can't take away the circumstances of the sources from the source themselves. So then you find, like, these aren't just documents, right? These are documents that did things. These are, you know, people saying things politically to have a point. And so, yeah, there are like thousands. I have a list of like, I think 500 oral poets just from Nigarhar alone in the 20th century who became famous. There is one Ghulam Jahan. And the reason why is because people channelized them successfully to the right places and the right one person. So you're right, there were nomads. They were performing Malang Jahan right across from Islamic College in Peshawar too, because people successfully channelized him in the right direction. That's an instructive lesson from history too. So you can learn two things from Malang Jahan. Number one, you can learn about Pashtun society in the 1950s. And that in itself is an important goal. Just like by looking at poets today, you can learn a lot of stuff about rural identity and rural politics today. However, by looking at Malang Jahan, the second thing you can learn is how you can successfully conduct, you know, basically a social outreach campaign. And that in itself is, you know, a possibly even more interesting historical and political question to me.
Second sentence, Schultz. So I'm curious how you launch a social campaign like that without tainting it with, you know, sort of the dirt of the American government. You're making look illegitimate,
right?
Domestic.
I'm not sure that the American government can launch a campaign like that for exactly the reason that you said. And I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, I'm a historian and I don't claim to interact in policy. So, you know, I have the luxury of asking a whole bunch of kinds of questions that policymakers can't afford to ask. I mean, that's my job.
Well, sir, do you think that sort of spirit still exists today in Afghanistan among that group of poets, that sort of egalitarian, liberal ideal? And is it, I mean, like your analogy of the hope and things that built the house, you know,
yeah.
Is that what we're waiting for? Is that the end game?
I mean, definitely there is a desire not to be ruled tribally. You know, just look at the kind of political problems. For example, in Waziristan, and it's a perfect example. So, when I was doing my field research in 2007 already, things were terrible in Waziristan. And so it's like the president of the Waziristan Students Federation was sitting in the shower because he couldn't do that work in Waziristan anymore. You know, he was organizing exactly these same kind of things. And the first time I met him in 2005, he was an optimistic kid. You know, he was full of hope for the future. By the time I saw him again, I mean, he was incredibly pessimistic. He couldn't go to Waziristan at all. His father told him, if you go back, then your uncle will probably do something terrible and nasty to us. And if they don't, then somebody else will do something terrible and nasty to the uncles and to us. You know, all this kind of stuff. And so he was just, it was terrible to see the change in this, right? The utter defeatism. And, you know, my biggest analogy is like the difference between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. You know, it gets to the point of people saying things that by any means necessary. And I haven't been working in this field for a long time, you know, and I can see the change in individuals between my first round of field research and my second round of field research. I mean, I'm, in short, pessimistic, but I don't think that you know, you can crush the spirit in people forever, and many people continue to be optimistic.
So you say that you don't believe that they want to be ruled tribally. I think that that's the exact opposite of what we think that they want.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's the East, and they're very tribal, right? More so than the South. The South, the tribes are much more fractured because Taliban had a campaign in order to fracture the tribes in the South. And yet, they become sharecroppers along the river lines. And we're trying to reverse that. What you just said is they don't want to be tribal based. I thought that's what you said.
No, that's exactly what I'm planning. And furthermore, my research is focused directly on the East. So, a lot of people who have a stake in the tribal system want nothing more than to be a tribal. That's exactly correct. And the question is chicken or egg kind of thing. So, you know, probably a number of you are familiar with the Jim Gantz document that just came out with One Tribe at a Time. Probably a lot of you are also familiar with the Human Terrains Report, that systems report that also came out recently, which says, okay, well, you know, actually, tribes don't seem to be that important. Now, part of it is that it's a different region, right? That's certainly part of the case. But in actual fact, just like in the case of Waziristan, and Moland Agency, Ningrahar, all these places have repeatedly been subject to, in the 1890s, you know, you have fakirs who lead these millenarian Islamic movements, basically around a charismatic individual who combines all the resentment of all the people who are on the outside of this tribal system, and, you know, eventually Khans have to join that thing, because otherwise they're just going to be wiped away. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. There are plenty of people who want nothing more than people to respect and indeed strengthen the tribal system. However, I mean, there's two ways of looking at a society. One is that a society is a unit which kind of thinks as a whole and goes in one direction. The other way is conflict. You know, every society is, you know, split by all kinds of different contradictions and conflicts and all this kind of stuff. And Pushkin society is no different. You know, if you benefit some group of people, you're always going to disadvantage others. And tribalism, for better or for worse, has disadvantaged a lot of people. And
Dr. Karen, thank you for your remarks. And Wang Zhang is a fascinating personality. And as I read about his biography, and he happens to be someone that I know a little bit about. Besides the dissent that he had at the local level, demonstrated against the political establishment, he was also able to join the political establishment. He actually went to Kabul. He actually became very close to the elite.
Yeah.
Because the major theme in his poetry, the issue of Pashtunistan,
right,
and the unity of the Pashtuns, was something that was very much on the political agenda of Daoud Khan. And I'm wondering to what extent the issue of Pashtunistan or the issue of the unity of the Pashtun, which I believe has its roots in the conflicting and at times shifting allegiances of the Pashtuns back and forth between a focus on the local level to the larger issue of the Pashtuns and their political and economic power. To what extent is that relevant today in that region based on your recent experience?
I'll start with the first part, and you're absolutely right. So what happened after Wang Zhang became notorious, after that he became famous. And the reason why is because Daoud Khan exactly saw a powerful thing, knew a powerful thing when he saw it. I mean, he was great at, you know, taking things from society and integrating it into the Daoud Khan machine, and making sure that it didn't bite him, you know, in the future. So that's what happened. And then, don't forget, I mean, Wang Zhang continued to criticize, like, snarkily Daoud Khan. You know, to the extent that he could, which was really not all that much, because nobody could really criticize it, it's not all that much. And then Long John died mysteriously after about 8 years of being in the pay of Tao Khan. So, weirdly, I've never seen any suspicion that anybody actually did away with him. But you do see a lot of anger in the kind of writing of Long John's death that the government never fixed the road that he fell off of. But in any case. So Pashtun unity is, it's important to note that Long John was talking about the unity of both sides of the international border. Basically more than anything else after Dao Khan started paying him. He was talking about, you know, that side. So the fact that Pakistan, the independent state of Pakistan, was jailing all of its most influential Pashtun leaders and all this stuff, and like using the Pakistani Air Force to bomb peaceful demonstrations of Pashtuns in the Northwestern here, all this stuff. He was talking about that a whole lot. Based on my present kind of experience, I think that a grassroots sense of unity between Pashtuns on both sides. No, the board is very much there, and the board is very much real in the imagination of people. Like, so everyone from Swat, for example, that I know is going to describe themselves as Pakistani. Not even if you just push them. You know, I'm a proud Pakistani citizen. You know, for example. Bizlam Masood, you know, when he's going to say, well, if India attacks, I'm going to defend my Pakistani brothers. Right? So even Bizlam Masood, who actually wanted to create his own independent emirate out there in the wilderness, is going to become Pakistani when, you know, when India starts knocking on the door. People make a lot of this fluid and porous border, and I would just say that it's like when I was growing up in Maine. We would go, I'm from an Air Force family, we were stationed at Loring Air Force Base at the time. And we'd go to sometimes like New Brunswick in Canada to go to McDonald's. And the simple reason was, it was the closest one. That doesn't mean, you go back and forth, the border's open, it's not a big deal. The border's not a big deal for the people who live right on it. But you go like 20 miles, 30 miles away from the border into the settled districts. And you know, the center of gravity is Peshawar, and it has been for quite a while, and Peshawar is tied to Islamabad's center of gravity. And you know, when people are on the village level, you know, the kind of center of gravity just for all the territory, except for right on the border, is, you know, very divergent. So yeah, I think that there's a very strongly developed sense of Afghanness or Pakistaniness that doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily diminished by the fluid border. Now, it's probably less so in parts of Afghanistan now. It's probably less so in parts of Pakistan now. But
I'm wondering from a historical perspective, if I quote one of his lines, that I see Pashtun, Pashtunistan, Pashtun, to Pashtun Nevi in Pakistan, Pashtun, the true Pashtuns reside in Pashtunistan, and they're not Pashtuns, it's in Pakistan. To what extent is that still a theme that the Taliban may explore on a nationalistic level rather than a religious level? Because I believe that a lot of the dissent in the area is not just religious dissent, it's political dissent that has its causes in the long history that where the Pashtuns feel that they don't have the rights that they are entitled to, the kind of independence. And when you bring the codes of Pashtun, Lali, and Nung and Dairat into that, then that turns into something that's hard to manage socially or politically.
Well, sure. I mean, the Pakistani state has been extremely good at alienating its Pashtun populations throughout its entire existence. I mean, if you drive in a minibus from like Peshawar to Faisalabad, you know, you get stopped so many times, and people get on the bus and film you and search your pockets and all this stuff and shake you down. The state does this to you multiple times. It doesn't do it if you're going in the other direction. So, I mean, you know, the inescapable conclusion is that we rule you, and, you know, you're a person of suspicion if you're coming this way, whereas we can go that way all we want. So it's like you're a subject and not a citizen.
even though that's not entirely true, right? People in the NWFP at least vote in the same way as other Protestants do. There's still kind of a cultural marginalization, I suppose, and the Taliban is very good at feeding on that. So, in essence, you know, for all the attention that's being paid under Musharraf to opening up the national media and all this stuff, just so, you know, we've had a, for the first time ever, like a really, really genuinely free media in Pakistan. But the more media you have, you know, it's just that many more chances to not see Pashtuns in it. Or if you're a Pashtun, it's that much more chance not to see your culture represented in public. And so the Taliban are good at feeding on that too. And the Taliban have been very good at exploiting the fact that Afghanistan's kings claimed to be Pashtun and didn't know Pashto. And even if they knew it a little bit, they didn't know it all that well. And even if they knew Pashto in some circumstances, they certainly didn't live like Pakhtuns, you know, quote unquote. And so, though I'm not sure that the Taliban represents, they represent a Pashtun nationalism by default, in that that's what they know and that's what they implement. So yeah, they're going to make sure that everybody in Kabul wears a sadar instead of a, and a parke instead of a, you know, a hat and a coat. However, I mean, I think that's because they think that's more Islamic, not because they're trying to unify a Pashtun territory across the I mean, so there's, in the book that Professor Tarsia did with Robert Cruz, right, that there's that article by Luce Jack about how the Taliban, you mentioned it, quite striking. The Taliban, when they were ruling in Luce province, actually sent out their dictates in Urdu. Right? I couldn't think of anything more clear than, like, Pakistan, like, Pashtuns who, like, have adopted Pakistan as their kind of a, I mean, this is the very national language that marginalizes Pashtun in its own house. They're using it as a de facto new language of governance in the English province.
Just to say, if you see it like Pashtuns, the all-powerful military in Pakistan, and you see the percentage of Pakistani officers being general officers and flag officers and what and what not,
right,
and the regiments they have, so you just cannot see it, say that it is a, it is because of that drug culture, Kalashnikov and money, counterfeit things coming from Afghanistan through this population, going through, that is the way the people are checked in going to Punjab.
Well,
and
that's the reason.
Another important thing is that you see the hierarchy in the civil government and you see the federal secretaries even today. You just Google, everybody can Google them and see their ethnicity. I think the population ratio which the Pathans have in Pakistan, we are, and the Baloch are complaining of this, that we are about 3%, three times more than that, that we should be having in the civil services and in the army.
Right.
So you see the army made up of so many Pathan regiments like FF and TF Force, and you see the general officers, you start seeing the chief of army staffs like Ayub Khan and Yahya Khan and what and what not. Zia-ul-Haq hailing from Peshawar, his family migrated and settled in Peshawar, Kalabadi. So if you see all this, so that kind of argument that you gave now, I just do not tend to agree with it, that Pakistani government is alienating them like this. And you see the currency, the bigger note at that time was 100 rupees. It had Islamia College at the back, and it did not have. So you just cannot say that the government was alienating this. This one thing was because of this Afghanistan coming, like poppy coming from the tribal areas and going to Punjab, so government used to do. And we used to, people like us also, if our cars are also checked, I am a brigadier general, I go and I start. And if I don't have to hide something, why should I be very, at the airport, what the Americans do with us that we come?
Sure.
So if don't I have, I don't have to hide something, why should I do, I got it.
Your points are all valid. And in support of what you're saying, I believe that Pashtuns are more, are disproportionately represented in the army, though they still represent the minority of the, though the percentage in the army is larger than the percentage of the general population of Pakistan as a whole. And
Certainly, yes. The reason why people are searched is because, you know, contraband, when you're going in that direction. On one of these occasions, you know, the guy sitting next to me had a lump of hashish in his pocket that size. And, you know, I usually don't whip out my passport at the earliest opportunity in Pakistan, but when the Punjab police get on the bus and, you know, they're like manhandling this guy and they start looking at me, you know, then it's time to pull out the passport or something. Just because there is a logical reason to do it doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt when it happens to you. And just because Pakhtuns are overrepresented in the military than their population in Pakistan as a whole, perception is more important than actual factual reality. And, you know, the only kind of Pashtun you can hear on the TV for the longest time ever was Khyber TV, and it's like people, at least the people that I knew, and I'll grant you, I spent a lot of time with people in like the Pashtun Academy in Peshawar who are probably more disposed to talk about their grievances than even the general population. I'll grant you that much. But, I mean, you know, they say it like, it's almost like, oh, yeah, thanks for the paper, throw us a bone, you know. Thanks for your stupid Khyber TV, which is representing Pakistani mainstream culture in the Pashto language and nothing else. Like that. So, yeah, I think there's still a pretty strong feeling of alienation from Pakistani public culture as a whole. It's probably not that strong in the first lecture, so I'd love to work on it.
I'd like to nail down a couple of different things. First of all, at the beginning of the talk, you were talking about tribalism as being imposed by government. And to try to go into a little more detail on that, would you say it was accurate to that government was attempts to take advantage of existing tribal identities
yes.
in order to make them the basis of government?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Which is a fairly normal phenomenon of governance in areas where tribal identities are present.
Although it must be said that when we really look at the ethnographic documentation going back as far as we have records, Pakistani kind of administration, collective administration of Pashtun regions. So, you know, like the political agent paradigm and the Afghan Laswali paradigm, these kind of things. They're building on a Mughal imperial practice doing the same thing. And actually, we do know that the Mughals created these tribes in a lot of cases out of thin air. So I'm not saying that the successor states created any identities out of thin air, no. They're using things that already exist. However, if you take something and then you rigidify it and you make it part of your administrative structure where it might just be a clan identity at some other point, then you're giving it a lot more salience than it would otherwise have. And you're making it a lot harder to negotiate around it. And you make it a lot kind of more rigid and... I always, with students, use the analogy that I'm from a French Canadian family. And French Canadian families, at least the ones I know, tend to be really huge. And I have about 300 cousins in the United States, in New England. And I've got another 500 to 800 cousins in Quebec. And if I go there and give everybody a couple months' notice and they take off work, I can meet all of them at once. Why are we not a clan? I mean, why are we not a tribe? The reason why is because we pay taxes separately and, you know, we do all these different things separately. And if I kill somebody, then the state's going to punish me and not the rest of my family and, you know, all these kind of things. And furthermore, I don't have to, like, rely on my great uncle to be the guy that all of my taxation goes through, like was the case in Afghanistan for a huge amount of time. You know, people don't change overnight. These kind of practices by the Afghan state still affect, the Afghan monarchic state still affect the way people think of themselves now. I mean, there's a good bit of lag. What I am saying is that people on the outside of that structure, you know, have less and less stake in it. And again, it's returning to the chicken and egg issue. So, like, if you say that you're going to work with the tribes, one tribe at a time, are you really, it's not like you're doing something that is just respecting what's already there. I mean, it's the same thing as the Afghan state. You're strengthening what's actually there and making it more meaningful than it would have been if you didn't interfere in the first place. So by doing one tribe at a time, you're strengthening the tribes that are there one tribe at a time. If you kind of do this like a, well, I don't know what else you would do, actually, frankly, in this situation. If you do a broad-based kind of appeal to the wretched of the earth, I mean, and you know, set up aid programs that emphasize the village identity or something, well, I'm sure that sooner or later that's going to change. However, we're still dealing with the categories that the Afghan state gave us, and the Afghan market state gave us. And Kuna province is a fantastic analogy. So this place, I mean, yeah, like, well, luckily, the Afghan Defense Ministry, around 2002 or 2003, they commissioned and put out a fantastic question book about all the tribes and all the history of Kunar province in the past 100, well, actually 1,000, but I care about the past 100 years. And, you know, you get the sense that tribes weren't all that important until basically the Musavvan regime came in and they're sending, like, Muhammad Gulhan's woman's family to go help pacify these people, and in doing so, they're building up elders in Kuna province, and they're, you know, creating people who, you know, didn't have all that much influence before into, you know, now. But I feel like, you know, my cousin in Quebec is a doctor, and suddenly because he's like relatively wealthier than the rest of them, people respect him more because he's a professional and all this stuff. Suddenly he becomes an elder, and then, you know, you start to give them administrative responsibilities because of this, and you're going to get a appointment sooner or later.
Set the follow up on.
I'm sorry, yeah, that was one way.
We academics do have a tendency. To follow up on that, you describe the poets of protest as marginal. You've talked about the people who are outside of the tribal or patriarchal hierarchy.
Yeah.
Would you give us some more concrete information on who those people are? Are you talking about people who are really marginal in the sense of, you know, peripheral, outside, or are you talking about essentially the bottom of the hierarchy?
In some cases, the bottom of the hierarchy. Balanjan himself was actually from a landed Pashtun family, but you know, circumstances can push you outside, right? He lost his inheritance of land when his father died when he was like a baby, and then his uncles kind of took over the land. What we have, and then kind of swept him aside. Now, also, like, for example, the scholar Sadiqula Rahdin was a woman from, I don't know, I forget what district, anyway. So he didn't have any extended family at all. He worked his way up through education, right? He kind of got in good with the school that was run by the Sahab of Hargada, I believe. And, you know, you can work your way up through education if you're being an intellectual. That's usually an indicator that you're not going to make it as a landed, you know, member of a landed gentry. So, yeah, in some cases, I am talking about professional castes. Like, if you're a dumb, and this is just a horribly pejorative word, it refers to musicians in these regions, also like barbers and professionals, and carpenters and message carriers. All these people, technically, they speak no other language than Pashto, but they're not even considered to be Pashtuns in a lot of places. And so, yeah, you could be that marginal. And a lot of the world poets were that marginal. I have a bunch of stuff, like critical poetry, that was written by actual Malans. And, of course, an actual Malan is a beggar. You know, he's dressed in rags. He goes from door to door getting handouts, or he goes to live, like, in a cemetery, or this kind of stuff. I mean, this guy's really on the edge of polite society. Or not in polite society. You know, he's in daily life, this guy can't even look you straight in the eye. You know, he doesn't have that kind of social persona. But certainly wouldn't criticize your poetry. Now, Taliban were, you know, up until quite recently, also sort of like that. They go from place to place, and they weren't really well-respected at all. And mullahs were also, like, in a lot of cases, not Pashtun. They were certainly professionals. This is like a caste system. So, you know, in some cases, when I mean marginal, I mean people just like outcast of just all semi or non-Pashtuns. Or, in the case of like Balang Jan, yeah, he's a sharecropper and like a casual servant. He was a bandit for a while. But that's because, you know, political, economic circumstances have nothing to do with tribal and pushed him outside of the, you know, pushed him outside of tribal avenues as viable for his life. And this happened a lot. This happened a lot starting in the 1920s. And this has to do with regional political economic shifts, like the British Empire reshuffling its economy to be more insular. Things like this. Nomads used to go as far as Thailand. By 1920, nomads really didn't go much further than Virasimhapon, Pashtun nomads didn't. This kind of really limited the resource base of the mountains. Also, like the eastern provinces in particular, like around 1930, up to that point, the British were constructing canals in Punjab like crazy, and they were building all kinds of stuff throughout the rest of British India. And, you know, there was a good deal of free labor mobility all through India. So Pashtuns used to go earn money in Bombay for a season, go back to, you know, what we now call Paktia, and live on that for the rest of the year. At a certain point, they couldn't do that anymore. At a certain point, there weren't any more canals being built. The Great Depression hit. Britain couldn't pay for it. People couldn't migrate from, you know, what is now like buddy poets for them in Nigar to go work on canals anymore. We have a lot of oral poetry from the 19-teens, which is talking about mobility and like how sad it is to leave your home and your loved ones. And by 1940, it's all talking about like blue, 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 and all the either very abstract local stuff, or it's talking about just like, you know, very local things. So what I'm saying is there were a lot of people who had a lot of avenues outside, and this kind of was a safety valve, economically and politically. When we cut off a region like this from its really broad resource base, then you start to get essentially like a proletariat that has no place to work, and that's pretty dangerous in a rural setting. So Malangan is one person like this.
Right. To try to close the loop. If the poets themselves are very much outsiders. But if the informational network that they constitute can become a source of social and political power, they have to be reaching a larger group. Who are they reaching?
Well, so if a poet or his musician followers, so every poet like performed by himself, but he also had a retinue, and the retinue could go perform by itself in all directions too. And his students would go all. So if you're performing at a village wedding, especially in those days, you're performing for the whole village, rich and poor, powerful and weak, you know, every single person. I mean, this still happens. In most of Pakistan, if you have a village wedding, then like a third of the whole village will show up, even in Punjab. And all the sort of songs that they're singing, everybody hears them. So the question is, what kind of songs are you singing? And not only that, you hire people from outside your district, or, you know, and so you can manipulate these variables in a very delicate fashion. Like, okay, well, if you have cultural studies personnel, like on a more elite level, who want people to travel more, then, you know, the next wedding by a village notable that comes along, you know, they might say, hey, well, we have got a poet for you, you'll love this guy, we're going to import him from, you know, Mona de la Soleil, and you're going to really like this. And so, you know, you can make sure that the people you want get greater exposure if you have a little bit more power, even if by themselves the poets wouldn't be able to travel as far as they might. That's one thing.
One last question. Anybody else?
Now, this is all in the period before cassette technology, right? So we have plenty of research on cassette poetry, much better than what I'm talking about here. So with cassettes, all bets are off, really. I mean, you know, truckers carry these things to all corners of the world. Merchant lines.
Yes, please.
Earlier you mentioned that part of the oral tradition is poetry and Friday sermons. Will you tell me if you want to have studied the Sufis' poetry?
Well, Malams are traditionally called Sufis too. I mean, so actually, Sufi poetry in Afghanistan, there's several varieties. Village Sufis tend to be critical of their pattern. For actually, in South Asia in general, I mean, look at something like Buddha Shah, the Sufi poet of like Lahore. You know, he talks about how great creative authority. You also have Sufis like in Afghanistan, like the Mujahideen family until quite recently, and they certainly aren't great at critical poetry. In fact, or like the Gaylani Brotherhood, that guy owns a Hindu worship in the Kabbalah. I mean, they were as close to the power structure as one could be, and still maintain some kind of independence. Yeah, I mean, Sufis are a bit too diffuse of a group to be lumped into one thing, and that's a biological really say.
But is it the trend is like with the core of Sufism, where a call for love of God and brotherhood and beauty and all this, you said they are critical or take political nationalistic aspect in their poetry?
Well, a love of God and a love of beauty doesn't actually rule out insurrection either. I mean, so like the great Sufi leader, the Sa'd ibn Qada, from the outskirts of Dawa, like had a bunch of khalifas all over the region who, I mean, these were the biggest problem for the British for a really long time. These guys were causing problems. But if you read some of their poems, yeah, they are talking about like mystic experiences and a very interior religiousness. On the other hand, yeah, they're actually quite politically active as well. Pakistan and Afghanistan both have been a really fertile area for activist Sufi networks who nonetheless speak a lot about love for God and love for your fellow humans. I mean, love for the human next to you, if you then think that human next to you is being oppressed by somebody else, can translate into violence against the third party.
I know we are running out of time.
Go ahead.
Really quick. I mean, thinking of the Pashtuns as warrior poets, the male population in particular, their self-image at least in perception, and thinking of the rich poetry, the oral poetry as well as the literature of Pashtun from Khoshal Khattak to Rahman Dalmat, how would you translate some of this in today's world to counter the extremism, the religious interpretation that arrived with Al-Qaeda, with elements of Salafism or Wahhabism that in my mind are alien to the context of Afghanistan?
To me, it seems like, the key poet that, I mean, he's still the most popular Pashto poet of all is Abdurrahman Baba from Village Azhar Khan. So, you know, his most famous poem is the one that goes, Kardaburu Kachi Sinobi Musashi. So it's like, you know, plant flowers where you live, don't plant thorns or else they'll stick in your toe eventually. And don't dig a pit for somebody else to fall into, because sooner or later you might just slip and fall into that same pit yourself. I mean, and this is about the most popular Pashto poet there is. I don't think that he's suffered any decline in his prestige to the current day. Even though he has somebody bombed his mausoleum recently. In a more comprehensive sense, exactly what you're describing is what the Peshmerga Academy of Shadow has been trying to do lately. There's Rajbali Shaharak, now heads the Peshmerga Department of Shadow University. And this is his whole big drive, right? And he created a whole new curriculum for the students, designed exactly for the reasons that you're talking about. As long as it's in such an elite setting as Peshawar University, I don't know what kind of exposure that's going to have on the mass. On the other hand, you might have people like the old Liz and Young who work with people in rural areas and all this kind of stuff. But as long as there's this distance from top to bottom and this kind of split between top to bottom, then now there's nothing possible.
On this theme, as I said, on 18th February, we will talk about the history and how Afghan history was written by someone who had looked and translated the main Afghan historical text, which is called Sirajul Tawarikh, but he talked about all the historians and what Professor Karen just said is how the Afghans see themselves, partially what you also heard is this whole notion of where the Pashtuns belong in the Afghan state. So we invite you again, Adam and myself, contact us 18th February, same bad time, same bad channel. Then the third speaker goes more to politics. It's Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who resigned or was fired from the UN because he exposed the internal problems in the African election. He has promised to spill the beans, as he told me, on 25th March. That will be same place as well, 25th March. And his title talk is Afghanistan, War of Necessity or Quagmire. So we leave from the history and go back more into a little bit of politics. And then, again, the theme that we just heard here, actually right in that, on April the 5th, Professor Shah Mahmood Hanifi, who teaches at George James Madison University in Western Virginia, will discuss the Pashtun counter-narrative. This is what we just heard here, which is he claims that this whole notion that Pashtuns have been the elite in Afghanistan is false, because the Pashtuns were there by blood, they were Pashtuns that we just heard, but they didn't do Pashtun. So we keep on going in this field, and again, as Professor Karen has just accepted to give us a paper, you will have a formal paper, you will collect from all the speakers, except one, Ambassador Galbraith is not giving a paper. We will give you a book at the end of that. Adam and I also have this recorded for PME or any use you want in our university or beyond. Please ask us for that. And before anything else, we want to thank you very, very much for starting.
For further information, please contact Dr. Amin Tarzi, Director of Middle East Studies at tarzia@grc.usmcu.edu or Adam C. Seitz, Senior Research Associate, Middle East Studies at seitzac@grc.usmcu.edu.